I'm Emma Newberry, and you're listening to one of the breakout sessions from Jewish Roadie Media, where we take conversations further and think more deeply with the guests who join us behind the mic. Today, I'm sitting down with Pardeep Singh Kalika and Arno Michaelis, a Sikh and a former white supremacist, who are advocates and experts in navigating and understanding hate and the ways it manifests in our communities. In 2012, the two of them were brought together through tragedy. On April 5th of that year, avowed white supremacist and member of Hammerskin Nation, Wade Michael Page, shot and killed seven people at the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin. Kalika's father, Satwant Singh Kalika, was the president and a founding member of the temple, and was the last of Page's victims on that day. He was found to have defended himself to the best of his ability with what he could find, a butter knife. At the time, Michaelis was 2 years out of the same hate group that Page belonged to. By 2012, he had left extremism behind and had founded Life After Hate, an organization dedicated to supporting people interested in leaving extremist groups. But the incident at the Sikh temple forced him to reflect on his influence in the extremist community and brought him into collaboration with Kalika under the nonprofit organization Serve to Unite to ensure that legacies of hate stop here and now. Keep listening to hear Kalika and Michaelis share the things they think about, old and new, 10 years into their time together as colleagues and as brothers.
My name is Arno Michaelis. I'm a storyteller. I do that storytelling typically in speaking, but also writing a fake it till you make it filmmaker. And my storytelling is really done with the intention of bringing about a world where all people are valued and included. And it's driven by my past as a white nationalist from 1987 to 1994.
Pardeep Kalika, I am... My current day job is the director of the Interfaith Conference, so I do a lot of work with interfaith communities. My background is I'm a clinician, and Arno jokes around about that and says that I'm trying to diagnose him every single day. We're together, so...
He didn't really develop an interest in mental health until we met.
Correlation is not causation, right? Yeah, so we've been working together for the past 10 years, and... it's great to work with my brother. It's great to catch up. It's great to be here.
You've been working together for a decade. How has your speaking, the way you interact, what you talk about shifted over those years?
Yeah. Obviously, our journey together started 10 years ago, but I think for us to be able to make sure that we're able to tell a story that opens up other stories. And, not just for where we go, but this America. And I think that that's kind of what we want to do. And in like a short way, maybe just thinking about making the world a more inclusive, loving place and having conversations across divides, providing a lesson, but also addressing otherness. So I think that's a lot of the work that we have done, continue to do.
I think it's really important and just kind of a short answer to what this world and what the society needs is for us to see ourselves in others and to see others in ourselves. And me and Pardeep's relationship, I think, is a great example of that. Mm-hmm. We were two boys born on opposite sides of the planet Earth, and our paths were convened by a really horrific hate crime. But once we sat down to talk and listen to each other and share a meal, we found out we had way more in common than different. And we're really inspired to try and cultivate that.
Can you talk a little bit about Serve to Unite?
Yeah, so Serve to Unite was born, days after the shooting happened itself. And I think there was something that was happening for us. It called on all of us to ask ourselves, what is going to define what just happened here? Who is going to define that? Is it going to be hate? Is it going to be the attacker? Or is it going to be the community who rises up and addresses that? Mm-hmm. And Serve to Unite was formed with that intention to make sure that we were the ones that define, and we as in the loving community. But, Serve to Unite, once it was formed, was formed by many of the people that belonged to the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin, a lot of the youth. And it was really the youth at that time that got out there and wanted to make sure that we showed who we were, really the need for us to commit ourselves to service.
Serve Tonight also is a perfect answer to violent extremist narratives, both in a prevention sense and in an intervention sense. I've been working internationally in counter-violent extremism for a decade, and I have a lot of friends who are formers like myself. In the CVE space, the word former means former violent extremist. I have also a lot of friends who are survivors of violent extremism like Pardeep is. And working with all these people, it becomes real apparent that there's basic human needs that violent extremist ideologies prey upon, needs of identity, purpose, and belonging. Those are needs that all of us have, and fortunately, the majority of human beings find healthy answers to those needs. But people who don't have healthy answers are really vulnerable to be swept up in violent extremist ideologies that provide very, like, seductive, exciting, but extremely toxic answers to those needs. So when young people or people of any age get together and they roll up their sleeves and they do physical work to improve things in their community, it answers those needs in a very healthy way. So in that sense, it prevents violent extremism. But also, if you get someone out of a violent extremist group, that's awesome. But the big issue that's front and center is that they have big holes where those identity, purpose, and belonging needs are. So if you can introduce them to service and teach them the value of the self-value that you gain from serving other people, that's a really powerful thing in helping them move forward.
And I mean, lots of communities, faith communities, school communities, got behind it. And as Arnold points out, it became this way to address social emotional growth of a child, of a teenager, of an adult, of a community, to say, okay, if you see a problem and now you can address that problem, right? Why can you not look into the mirror and address your own personal issues that are happening? And I think that we wanted to make sure that we were getting away from being such a problem-centered society to be much more solution-focused.
That's really interesting that sort of like outside to inside way of doing things. Because I was going to ask, I guess, both of you, but maybe directed more to Arno, how do you sort of start to explain or start to help people understand a journey out of hate without also oversimplifying something that's really complex?
To put it simply, when you hate yourself, you're not going to be able to love anyone. Everything really starts from within, and what it goes from your self-image outward. So if you have a sense of inner peace and you work on practicing it and cultivating it on a daily basis, it really is conducive to seeing the world around you with curiosity, whether you're seeing other people or other cultures, whatever it is. Like you're not threatened by those things because you have a good sense of who you are. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you don't have that sense of inner peace, if you have inner turmoil, you have traumas that are unresolved and untreated, and they affect the way that you think every waking moment of your day, that's when you can find people who don't look like you threatening, or you find a different culture or a different faith tradition intimidating to you because it's unfamiliar. So I think that the difference between intimidation and curiosity is that sense of inner peace. And that's, again, going back to service, that's what service does, is that you, not in an arrogant way, but you can go to sleep at night just thinking, like, I'm trying to be the best person I can be. And I'm not perfect, and I never will be, but I need to keep working on it, and I'm happy doing that work.
You know, Emma, one of the key takeaways that I didn't think about until you just posed that question was really, like, there has to be somewhat of a, and we do this work now with an organization called Parents for Peace, and we try to help, you know, a loved one calls in, They have somebody in their family who is getting into radicalization, extremism, and some of the people, the families, you know, that they're in different places, right? But I think that somehow, some way, you have to introduce it in a loving way. So you have to build trust. You have, and you know, interesting, I was thinking about alliances. I'm looking at, you know, the Jewish alliance, and you do need to have somewhat of an alliance, right? Because when you start to work with somebody, you can't just simply make it about them. You cannot be like, well, this is all about you, and I need you to change. But somehow, some way, you have to remove that personalization. And I think some of the reasons why we've been so effective is that oftentimes Arno and I can look past the presenting behavior, what is right in front of us, whereas society seems to be only stuck on the presenting behavior and judging the presenting behavior. Yeah, I know that's what you're telling me, but what's behind that? Why are you, what role is it playing in your life, and how can we address that? And oftentimes we get people who may be very hateful to somebody else, and to us, it's like it's a cry for help.
Do you feel like that describes how you felt as a young person being drawn into extremism?
Yeah, absolutely. A dear mutual friend of ours is a guy named Chris Buckley, who I helped to get out of the Ku Klux Klan in 2016. And Chris said that hate's a cry for help. It was the first time I heard those words put together like that. And it's just such a powerful truth. And looking back in my experience, I would absolutely say that applies. And in my case, it was puzzling. It was an outlier. Because if you look at my childhood, it was pretty idyllic. A lot of formers I met, the majority of them had severe adverse childhood experiences and went through really rough times. I didn't. For me, it was a mix of nature and nurture, just the way everything in life is. But it was part my personality type, and part I did go through trauma in that my father's alcoholism made my mother's life really stressful, because he's partying when he's supposed to be working, and we're living beyond our means. And the financial stress that my mom had working two jobs, trying to handle me, who was this absolutely wild little kid, and my little brother, and then my absolutely wild dad. The whole time I grew up, my mom was miserable, and she was suicidal. And I could feel that as a kid. And rather than be like, hey, mom, I love you, how can I help? I just started to distance myself from her and from my dad, who loved me very much despite the disease he had. And that distancing made me suffer more. I started lashing out. Hurt people. And that's, so by the time I got to be a 16-year-old alcoholic myself and really conditioned to violence and repulsing people and lashing out, that's when I was introduced to white nationalist ideology. It was certainly a cry for help. I wouldn't have said that at the time, of course, because it's a hard thing to do for any human being to say, hey, I need help. Can you help me? Can someone help me? And it's especially hard for men and young men, especially, because it's seen as a sign of weakness. And so rather than ask for help, it's so much easier to hate this person and hate that person and direct all this turmoil that you're feeling inside in an outward direction.
And maybe even like if you hate them first, you're not giving them a chance to push you away too, right?
Yeah, you got it.
Bart, do you want to tell a story?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, Emma, you got it. And a lot of times that's not understood. Mm-hmm. By so many people. It's like, this kid is just hateful. They're evil. They're bad. We have so many ways that we judge somebody, right? Yeah. And there was a time we were working with a school out of by Middle Madison, Middle State, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And they said the same thing about this kid. He's racist. He's this. He's that. And they were saying, well, he's, you know, in the hallways with a cape of a Confederate flag as a cape, running around like as if he's like sort of like Confederate Superman. And intimidating.
Sorry.
So yeah, no, you get the visual picture, right?
Yeah,
here's
funny.
This kid running around with a cape.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, the school is upset. Everybody's upset, and they should be upset. And just kind of asked many of the students that were there with us that night, hey, is this kid, you know, is he a loner? Is he popular? Do other people follow him? Does he get the invites? Does he, you know, what kind of kid is it? Tell me about the kid. And they're like, oh, he's kind of a loner. He's, you know, he's not that popular. Nobody really follows him. And you know, one of the things that we kind of came to was really, you know, you have a kid who's preemptively rejecting himself because it hurts him so bad. So, and we see this over and over again, that sometimes this ideology, as much as, I mean, it's gross, right? The ideology should be rejected, not the person, but the ideology, right? But what we do sometimes is we reject the person with the ideology. That person is taking up that ideology because they know it's gross to the world, but they also feel gross. So instead of them feeling like they have to go through a personal rejection, they say, oh, you know what? They're rejecting my hatefulness, and they should. And that makes them feel better.
A 16-year-old boy to have an option between saying, hey, you know, hi, my name's John. Would you be my friend? You know, I hope people like me. I hope I can do well in school. It's so much easier to wrap a Confederate flag around your neck and run around with it and going, oh, see, I knew they were going to reject me anyway. It's an easy, seductive way out. The same way heroin is easy and seductive. It's a lot of what we do in Parents for Peace is to make the point that violent extremism is a public health issue and that hate can actually be an addiction. And there's been a lot of science, neuroscience studies, mental health professional studies that look at the areas of the brain that are activated when someone is like actively hating someone, and they're all the same stimulation centers that heroin and cocaine and alcohol activate.
That was actually my next question to you.
Right on. We're still on the same page.
Well, because I know you drew that parallel in the book too, like your own experience with alcoholism, feeling like extremism is an addiction and is a disease in a way.
Absolutely. And there's parallel after parallel after parallel between violent extremism and substance abuse. And my substance that I personally cannot enjoy responsibly is alcohol. I drank profusely for 20 years. I quit in 2004, haven't had a drop since. I'm delighted about that every day. But I know what it's like to be an alcoholic, and I know what it's like to be addicted to white nationalist ideology. And two parallels I'll touch on quickly is the one that came about first was I knew what I was doing was wrong. I knew why swastikas repulsed people. I wasn't ignorant to that. I didn't care as long as I got the thrill of that repulsion in the exact same way that a heroin junkie knows it's wrong to prostitute themselves for drugs. They don't feel great about that by any stretch, but they don't care. The fix is more important than anything else, and it makes you do horrible things. So that's one very clear and very powerful parallel. Another parallel that I think is just as clear and powerful is the concept of rock bottom. If you go to any 12-step meeting, whether it's NA or AA, everyone at those meetings got there because they had some kind of rock bottom moment. Something really horrible happened that brought them to the point where they're like, I can't do this anymore. I need help. Exact same process getting out of any kind of violent extremist group. Mm-hmm. We have another mutual friend named Mubeen Sheikh, also works for Parents for Peace, and Mubeen's a former jihadi. And it was when 9/11 happened, as he was conditioned to as a jihadi, he shouted Allahu Akbar and give a big cheer when the planes first hit the Twin Towers. But then the next day, he's working in a high-rise in downtown Toronto. He's pulling into the parking garage, looking up at the building he works in, and he's thinking about everybody he works with. And his first thought, being very geared into Muslim supremacy, is like, hey, there's a lot of Muslims on my floor. Like, they don't deserve to die. And then his next thought that was almost involuntary is like, well, no one else deserves to die either. Like, is this really what I want to associate myself with? And that was his rock bottom. So every former you ever talk to will have a rock bottom story like that, where something happened that had them so low that they're like, I can't do this anymore. I got to quit.
Something that really just affected me and I was curious about in terms of your personal journey was that you had left violent extremism, and then obviously the shooting happened and the perpetrator, you didn't know him personally, but
right.
It almost seemed to me like that was a secondary rock bottom. Like, you had obviously come to terms with your own desire to leave, and then, like, what was that like to experience that after having done Life After Hate and doing all this work for to take yourself out of that?
That's really deep, Emma, and it certainly was. It was. I think what August 5th, 2012 did for me was really kind of like change the focus of my storytelling and my work from my own just like survival, which is what brought it up in the first place. Like, I had to reconcile my past or it was going to consume me. That's what motivated me to go public with my story in 2010. From the get-go, I was committed to helping other people. I hope people can hear my story and make some better decisions and not, hopefully not go down the path that I went. Mm-hmm. But when August 5th, 2012 happened, it really drove home to me like how important it is to prevent violent extremism. It really brought my dedication up to the next level and drove home the crucial nature of the work.
I'm thinking about this concept of rock bottom, and really even from a survivor's point of view, is that I think sometimes it's a great place to build a new beginning. And for us, we came to this country, you know, 1982. I watched my parents really work, you know, just like any other immigrant, any other person that comes here, work their butt off to try to make it here. And by the time that August 5th, 2012 happened, they had sort of achieved what was deemed the American dream. They created a nice life for themselves, lived in the suburbs. You know, I came from a place of humble beginnings, but I think by that time, my father, you know, created this temple. He had done what he needed to do. And I remember the last time that I saw him would be my birthday. And we celebrated and we had a good time. And, you know, within the dynamics of a first generation relationship with a father who's coming over, who's used to, you know, just the hard work that they do. And then you come here, you can never work hard enough. And, and interestingly, that rock bottom on August 5th started another chapter of my life to say, whatever you had done, you know, before that I'd been a police officer. Right. I had been a teacher working with at-risk high school youth. My undergrad was in sociology and criminal justice. So I've always been that minded. Mm-hmm. But in a way, something said, you're not doing enough. And I don't know whether it was the spirit of that work ethic, that immigrant work ethic, that you can do more. You're doing what you can, and you know, it's almost like absolvement. And so what I need you to do is really, really commit and really work your ass off. Yeah, so I think but the past 10 years has been incredibly difficult on both of us, on our families. But at the same time, we know that there's something pushing us. There's something that's kind of working through us. Whether we call that God, we call it faith, we call it Allah, we call it other, you know, we call it Vaiguru, whatever that is. I think we all have the spirit of that, all of us. And I feel like at this point in 2022, we're all being called to do more. We're all being called to be healers. You know, I embrace rock bottom, and I embrace another rock bottom, right? so there's going to be another one, right? And I think that's it's a beautiful place to lay a foundation as we kind of go forward. And I think that it speaks to the reconciliation that maybe this country needs to go to. Make sure that the promise of what America was supposed to always be can be revisited.
What are sort of some of the things that you do to have compassion for yourselves and self-care and, you know, care for people you love as you're doing work like this? Because as you said, I'm sure it can be really hard.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
what's self-care?
Not coming directly here from a 3 a.m. wake-up.
No, I think that, and again, this is going to sound a bit cliche, a bit corny, but we have been surrounded by so much wonderful, beautiful community. We have been supported along this journey the entire time. You know, there are times where we do things and nobody sees it, and there's times when, you know, lots of people see it. We've never been alone. And I think that we've known that, is that sometimes community can feel all alone, especially when something like this does happen, right? You feel like, oh my God, we did all of this work to try to live this American dream, become Americans. We did everything right, and still somebody from this country told us that we weren't enough. Yeah. And how many people are being told in this moment that they're not enough, right? And so, but we just always, when we get tired, something comes along and helps.
I just feel lucky every day to have amazing people in my life like Party. Like you, Emma, who I just met. It's everywhere we go, we meet amazing people who are really inspired by our stories, but also want to help facilitate those stories to reach a wider audience and to scale outward more. And we couldn't do it without every single person that we've encountered along the way. And I wouldn't. A lot of people are like, "Oh, it's so, you know, it was so hard for you to leave, and good job, and I'm so happy you left." And I'm like, "Well, no one's happier than me." And yeah, it was hard, but like, I couldn't. It would not have happened without these planets aligning of, yeah, from people who treated me to kindness when I didn't deserve it, to my parents who never gave up on me. And then at the same time, I'm all about self-care. I meditate and I work out and I get into the ocean every chance I get. And those are my, and I love to read. Those are all part of my self-care regimen as well.
And it's strange, you know, right? Like, things work and conspire to kind of present themselves when you do feel a little tired or fatigued. You know, there was a guy yesterday, and I met him for coffee, and he starts to tell me about where he lives, and I'm like, "Oh, I live like 4 blocks away from you." I didn't know that. And he's like, "Party, I moved here a month before the shooting happened." Wow. And he's like, "What I witnessed, what I watched you do, I never really told you, but I knew that you were operating from a different place." And he's like, "The way that you didn't allow hate to dictate things." And I was like, "Man, like, here's a person who noticed it. I've never met him. I don't know him, but somehow, some way, people are, they see it. They get it, and they embody it."
I'm interested to hear your thoughts on kind of the viral quality of hate that has emerged, I would say, like, for younger generations. Do you feel like that's a different kind of monster to tackle, or, you know, like, how does that affect how you're approaching things?
I'll talk about my kids in a second, but some of the kids that we do get as far as referrals, mm-hmm, you see that they're on the spectrum. They're struggling with things. Like Arnold pointed out before, with addiction, you know, you can say, okay, that's addiction to a substance or alcohol. I can see that. But with addiction to hate, there's a fixation too. Mm-hmm. And lots of kids or adults who are on the spectrum are already obsessive, are already kind of in that mindset. Now you see sort of social media pigeonholing people and saying, okay, if I'm obsessed with this, I keep getting more and more and more of it. Right. Whereas before, there was a corrective exposure part of that. Now that doesn't exist as much. And now you get all kinds of confirmation bias of why your obsession is actually right. Yeah. So it becomes even more challenging because of the algorithms of life. So we do see that, and it's important for us to teach our kids how to be mindful on social media. It's one of those things that it's not going anywhere. Right, and they need to know, why is it that they're looking at this particular TikTok? Why is the algorithm showing this? Why is that coming up? And my kids are good at knowing that, mm-hmm, but I don't think that society has come to that where they understand that. And you will see, like, for both of us, our kids are definitely the, you know, it's when we talk about coping mechanisms. I don't want my kids to be a coping mechanism, but watching them navigate the world, seeing their joy, seeing how they see things. And, you know, my wife was 7 months pregnant when this all happened. And within our culture, we have something called a Guru Granth, which is a holy scripture book. So we name the child by the first letter of the paragraph. And she wanted to name him Rohan. Rohan meant healing. And sure enough, that's what showed up. And, you know, an R is not that common of a word that comes up. But, you know, all of our kids, the people that have touched us, there's something to that where we almost need that as well.
Yeah, children are such a huge driver of everything we're doing. It is very cliche to say, like, oh, this is for the children. And I should point out also, when I was a white nationalist, I would claim that it was for the sake of my, you know, our white children that I'm engaging in this fight. And if you talk to any member of the so-called Islamic State, they'll say the exact same thing. It is very true in the sense that, going back to our buddy Chris Buckley, when I met Chris, he was an Imperial Nighthawk of the Ku Klux Klan. His 4-year-old son at the time had his own little Klan robe. And he would do a white power salute alongside his dad. And his son was a hurt, mean little kid. He was exactly like his dad was at that point. Today, with all the strides Chris has made, and Chris is now the director of White Nationalist Intervention for Parents for Peace. Mm-hmm. And his son, CJ, who's 10 now, is like the happiest, nicest little kid you'd ever meet. He's a Little League star. I'm super proud of him. And that's what this boils down to. So when people see someone like Chris was, they see a vicious, hateful, vile member of a hate group, and their knee-jerk reaction is like, to hell with that guy. I don't care if he reforms. I want him gone. I want him out of the society. You're not considering who comes with him. Either way he goes. And so that's why we can't give up on anyone. Is because of our children, because we want to have a world where our children can live safe and happy lives in.
When you think of, obviously it's not a dichotomy like hate and love, there's more complexity to it, but do you see those things in your work and personally as something that can be taught, or is it something that everyone sort of holds in them? What's your philosophy on that?
Yeah, so that's very, very much at the, you know, a lot of people complicate Sikhi and Sikhism, but that's very much at the root of what Sikhi is. Na koi mara kano, na koi mura. And what that basically is saying is that there is no bad and there is no good, and I am not neither bad nor am I good. That both of those spirits resonate inside all of us. And will exist in this world as well. And this will be a constant sort of thing, right? Energy. And so when we think about, yeah, the work that we do, we have to understand hate. You have to understand it from a personal standpoint and from a communal standpoint. For me personally, I had to understand that about Wade Page. One of the first people that I kind of contacted, who's now the director of the Life After Hate, Pete Simi, who's a professor, and I knew Pete had done some work with other extremists and had, you know, he's spoken to Wade Page. And so I reached out to him and I said, you know, in the pictures, he doesn't look like the most popular person. He looks like he's on the outside of photos. He looks like he's trying to be part of the crowd. Even within, you know, he's around his buddies drinking and this and that. I'm like, this guy is, you know, I knew even at that moment, right? This is weeks after when I'm talking to Pete. I'm like, this guy was not loved. Even within the movement that he was rejected. I'm always trying to see what's behind. And usually you see that, yeah, like, both of those energies exist in all of us. You know, the old native proverb or story goes into, like, you know, the grandfather's talking to his grandson and talking about his dad, and, you know, his dad passes away and says, your dad had two wolves inside of him, the good wolf and the bad wolf. And the grandson asks, like, which wolf, you know, which wolf wins, the one that you feed. That's for a lot of us, we have to be mindful of the wolf that we feed. In society, which wolf are we feeding? What's happening right now are incredible injustices across the world. Our planet needs us to get this right. The future generations need us to get this right.
Breakout Sessions is brought to you by Jewish Rhodey Media and made possible by the Jewish Alliance of Greater Rhode Island. Today's episode was edited, produced, and hosted by Emma Newberry. Special thanks to Pardeep, Arno, and to the Jewish Alliance's Community Relations Council for helping to arrange this interview. If you enjoyed today's special episode, please give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, follow us on Spotify, and tell two friends about our show. If today's episode shows us anything, it's how just a few words can make a huge impact. For more information on the work our CRC is doing or on Jewish Rhodey Media's projects, you can head to jewishallianceri.org or to jewishrhodey.com, where you can also find us on social media. Thank you all so much for listening. See you next time.